the work that I've been doing since 87 in this area is in some ways some of the least successful work I've done, and I've been involved in other unsuccessful work in my life, but also is in some ways the most interesting work that I've ever done. It's the first time, and I only formulated it this way actually in a meeting of the people, other teachers doing classes here. I've worked a number of times in my life on conflicts or in conflicts, whether it was Vietnam or the Civil Rights Movement or Southern Africa or what. This is the first time that I've ever worked on a conflict in which the committee I work for has the conflict within it. And of course, it's a very different experience of working on conflict. I mean, one of the differences that's very simple, perhaps almost too obvious, is that it tends to keep you a bit more humble than if you work on a conflict where you think it's us versus them. Where in this instance, the us's and the them's are all us's. and in a sense, that keeps you more humble because you realize, you know that here are the people of the conflict with the very strong loyalties to the different sides. Actually, I'd like to begin, before we get into today's subject, what we did in the first session was to do a kind of review, a quick review of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, looking at some of the possibilities for peace today. Yesterday, what we did was to look at the three traditions, actually really only at two. Since we're Christians, we're more familiar with our own. We looked at the Jewish tradition, the Islamic tradition, at some of the ideas and values in those two traditions, which provide a kind of basis, a moral basis for working for peace. Today we're going to look at some of the problems among American Jews, Christians, and Muslims in working together. And then tomorrow look at the issue of Jerusalem, which usually, you know, it's common in discussion about the Middle East that people begin to feel a little bit hopeful about the possibility for peace and want to get back to feeling pessimistic again. They will raise a question about Jerusalem. It sort of goes like this, you know, you've given me some sense that peace may be possible, but what about Jerusalem? In the sense that there, now, won't that prove that it's impossible? And in some ways it does. So we'll come to that tomorrow. But I'd like to begin, if you wouldn't mind sharing your story. Before.
Yes, I was just mentioning to Ron before the meeting, before the class started, that my first exposure to this whole problem was when I was at boarding school in 1967 in England. And one of my good friends was a girl called Jane, who was the daughter of a fairly important and leading Zionist in Britain at the time, an Englishman. And my another good friend, sort of through a slightly different route, was the sister of King Hussein of Jordan. And so then in 1967, here they both were, both with brothers fighting, I mean, one actually leading the Jordanian side, and my friend Jane's two brothers, although they were British, they went out to Israel to fight. And what happened is they both decided to launch appeals on behalf of soldiers and their families. And Jane's appeal got thousands and thousands of pounds from lots and lots of parents in the school. But because of the sort of current climate and the sort of current general feeling towards Arabs, Princess Basma's appeal got virtually nothing. And it was just sort of very pathetic. And it struck me, since I knew both of them, to suggest to them that perhaps at the age of 16 they weren't necessarily qualified to judge the rights and the wrongs, and would it be possible to combine their two appeals? Well, they did, and they became very firm friends, and they remained friends. They were at Oxford together, and Jane and her whole family, who were very influential Jews in Britain, became very close friends with King Hussein and his family. So that was just one little illustration of how some contact can be made.
Marvelous story. I partly ask you to tell it because it just doesn't fit the sort of image of how things work on this conflict, and it's obviously part of the picture. When I lead trips to the Middle East, which I do from time to time, the most extraordinary trip was last December, where we had 24 American Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders from different cities go together and to Israel, to the West Bank, to Egypt, Jordan, and Syria.
And we met with a variety of people, including foreign ministers in each of the countries, a prominent leader of the PLO in Egypt, other Palestinian leaders, of course, President Mubarak for about an hour and a half, U.S. Embassy people, and most of the people on the trip didn't know each other before they went, and came back just having had an extraordinary experience with each other. I mean, one Jewish leader wrote an article in Reform Judaism, which went out to about 285,000 American Jewish families, in which he began by saying how his wife and he, on the way to the airport, were worried that they wouldn't be able to remember the Arab names, Arab-American names of people in the group, and how when they got back, that was such a small issue. I mean, it was just, you know, they now knew they knew the people. And of course, that in knowing the people, you remember their names. I mean, it's not a question of a name on the list anymore. It's a person, and you have a relationship with them. The committee's doing another such trip, November 28th through December 10th this year. Some of you might be interested. This is the joint statement that was issued by the 24 Jews, Christians, Muslims who went, and that's up here for your taking. On such trips, I always say in the beginning that the purpose of going is, first of all, to understand and not so much to judge. It's very difficult to do. I mean, we all bring certain judgments, whether they're judgments from a standpoint of thick involvement and sense of loyalty in the conflict to one side or another side, or thick ideas that we have without any particular strong involvement in the conflict. We just come with our ideas. And I try to help people to see that the value of going out there and spending 10 days in these intense schedule of meeting all these people is really, no matter how difficult the person may be that we're meeting with and how difficult the ideas of that person may be that you're hearing, to somehow try to frame questions that don't just say your view of what the person is saying, but rather try to draw the person out in some sense so that you understand better why that person is saying and taking the positions that he or she is taking. And I think that's what I want to try to do this afternoon in terms of based on my experience, what are some of the issues for American Jews, for American Muslims, and Arab American Christians, and I'll lump them together for the purposes of this discussion, though they obviously are different, have different experiences in different contexts. And third, for non-Arab American Christians, that what are some of the difficulties, what are some of the reasons that were issues that we have to deal with if we're going to try to work together? And I'm going to begin with American Jews, and some of you may have read this, and as I say, there is a kind of summary of this, which was an article and a kind of talk, in this sort of ivory-colored paper. A rabbi friend of mine and his son, 7-year-old son, were sitting in front of television just a few years ago and watching a scene on the evening news from Gaza. And the scene was of Israeli soldiers, Palestinian kids, teenagers, had thrown stones at Israeli jeep, quite a common scene in the Gaza Strip or West Bank. And Israeli soldiers were chasing these Palestinian teenagers down through the camp, and the television camera was right there catching it, and saw actually the Palestinian kids caught by an Israeli soldier and being beaten. And this young boy, 7 years old, turned to his father, the rabbi, and said, "Father, why? Why are those soldiers beating those Jewish kids?" That's the point. But the kid said, "Why are those soldiers beating those Jewish kids?" And rabbi said to his son, "Oh, son, you didn't understand. Those soldiers are Jewish soldiers. Those are Israeli soldiers. Those are Jewish soldiers. And the kids are Palestinian. They're Arabs." And the son looked at his father, absolutely not able to comprehend it, and said, "That couldn't be." And what that says, I think, is that for many Jews, the history of the Jewish people is such that victim, being the victim, is almost a built-in part of self-definition. To the extent that the idea that Jews could be victimizers is a very, very difficult idea to assimilate, to accept. Abba Ibn, once responding to a group of American political scientists who were meeting with him in a hotel and asking questions about an election campaign. One of the American political scientists asks, Mr. Eban, I hope you don't consider this an insensitive question. He said, but aren't Israelis, don't you have an abnormal concern about your security? And Abba Eban said, yes, we do. He said, but then the history of the Jewish people is not a normal history. The point of these stories is to, in a brief way, try to suggest why it may be very difficult for many, not all, but many Jews to cope with the idea that Jewish people, having gotten state power, which of course for most of the history of Jewish people, it's one of the things that Jews didn't have. They're not used to having state power since biblical times. That having state power, it's hard for Jews to accept, to assimilate, to deal with the fact that having state power, Israel has done many of the things with state power that other states have done. And in that sense, they're kind of normal. But it's hard for Jews having this unique history as Jews to accept that. Second thing that I think is an issue for Jews in working with others on this issue is that there's a tremendous difference between what a discussion about this issue might be like among Jews in contrast to what it's often like when it's in public or with others, non-Jews. Every poll that has been done in this country in the Jewish community has shown that a majority of American Jews, usually the percentage is up in the 60s and 70%, support the right of Palestinians to self-determination. And indeed, one poll done within the last couple of years, in fact, it was done by a group called Nishma, which is a mainstream Jewish group, Jewish organization, supporting the possibility of peace. I say mainstream in the sense that among its board of directors are six former presidents of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. This is the sort of gathering place of the most mainstream American Jewish leadership. And six of the head, six of the board members of this organization, Nishma, are former presidents of that organization. So it's a reasonably mainstream Jewish organization, though you would say on the liberal side of the spectrum. They commissioned a poll, and what the poll was a poll of Jewish Federation leadership, some 400 American Jewish leaders actively involved in the leadership of the Jewish Federation, which is certainly one of the main, maybe most mainstream of Jewish organizations. And what the poll showed was that 65% of these Jewish leaders, American Jewish leaders, supported the right of Palestinians to an independent state as long as it didn't endanger the security of Israel. Now, my guess is that the prevailing view outside of the Jewish community, among, say, American Christians, certainly also among Arab Christians and Muslims, is quite surprised at that poll. Because the sense is that the American Jewish community is supportive of Israel, whatever Israel does, is one simple way that people say it, or very defensive about Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what explains this tremendous gap between a certain public impression in the wider community and what you find if you do a poll or if you go into the Jewish community and talk with people more privately in a certain sense? And I think what explains it, pretty simply, is that there is among the most successful, among many of the most successful, most sophisticated, most well-educated Jewish leaders, and among the Jewish community as a whole, a bone-deep worry about how much they can count on people outside of the Jewish community to support Israel. Now somebody will quickly say, but my goodness, several billion dollars of aid to Israel each year? Isn't this evidence of support? Well, indeed it is a kind of evidence of support. But what's interesting, it doesn't take away the bone-deep nervousness that Jews have about whether they really can trust non-Jews when it comes to support for Israel. And the fear that bone-deep worry stimulates is a fear that if Jews take their criticism of Israel, and when I said this business about 65% of Jews support Palestinian self-determination,
What that says in another way is that 65% of American Jews were not very happy with the Begin-Shamir governments, which were very conservative. Most American Jews would favor and are pleased now that there's a Labor government in Israel. Most American Jews, not all, but most American Jews, when they went to Israel, were very uncomfortable listening to Begin and Shamir. But they were nervous if they took that criticism, if they said that publicly. What they were fearful of is that it would be used by others in some way that might undermine the security or even eventually the survival of Israel. And of course, those fears are only in part based on experiences about modern-day Israel. Those fears, it seems quite clear from all the evidence, are built-in fears of being Jewish based on the experience of Jews, not just since 1948, but certainly the experience of Jews in the 20th century and over many centuries. Remember, it's 50 years only since the Holocaust and since Jewish people were essentially abandoned by the world community. Yes?
I just want to say that it may also be the fear that if they speak out against the Israeli government, our government and people here will say, aha, see, even the Jews don't think we should support their government. And then...
Well, that's kind of, I mean, that's an example of what I meant by fear of how they're speaking out publicly might be used, might be misused, used. And what that fear relates to is a kind of basic fear of how much can we count on public support of Israel outside of the Jewish community. Yes?
I think it's also strengthened by the evidence of rising intolerance in different places in the world. You know, the things happening with neo-Nazis in Germany, some of the things happening in South America.
Yes. Certainly any outbreaks of anti-immigrant, anti-Jewish, anti-black prejudice, the stuff that's been going on in Germany, feeds those fears. But I would say that even with relatively little evidence to substantiate the fears, why I call them bone deep, is they are not fears that you sort of decide to put out of your mind. They're fears in a certain sense that you live with almost in a blood way. I mean, that they're with you, you know? Third issue for American Jews is that for American Jews to work with American Palestinians, now this is a particular point about Palestinians, means being forced to confront the what I call the other side of the story of the creation of Israel. Now, in my own sense, my own experience, my own conviction, the creation of modern-day Israel out of the ashes of the Holocaust is one of the miracles of the human spirit. That is to say, I mean, I can't say it in any less strong terms, that the fact that a people out of the Holocaust, coming out of the Holocaust experience, coming out of Europe, coming out of Nazism, coming out of fascism, could create a state, and a state on the whole as decent and progressive and you know supportive of its people as the Jews created in modern day Israel, to me is an incredible miracle. I mean, it's one of the testimonies to what the human spirit can sustain and survive and go on from. But one has to, if one deals with the Palestinians, if one is going to work, if one is going to develop a relationship with American Palestinian, one will inevitably have to hear the biographical story of that family. And that family's story is a story of having become a refugee, having been in one way or another pushed out of the land that they feel was theirs. And in a way, it should be no surprise that Jews, after the Holocaust, and after the sense of this incredible achievement of creating Israel, would not want to deal with that. You know? I mean, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? That I have to deal with some moral ambiguity about the creation of Israel? It's just too much. It's not fair to ask it of me. Now, I'm not saying it's healthy not to deal with it. I'm saying, in terms of trying to understand why Jews might not want to deal with Palestinians and confront the biographical story of them, where is your family from, you know? They're from Haifa, or they're from Jaffa, which is Tel Aviv, the southern part of Tel Aviv. They're from Jaffa. And what happened to them? How did you get here? Well, there's a story there, and it's a story that's not happy. It involves suffering, it involves dislocation, it involves pain, it involves some death. So that's a third thing, a third issue that I think American Jews, many, have to deal with. And the fourth is that in working, in the idea, just in the idea that we should work together, we should all work together to try to press our government, encourage our government to help achieve peace, a Jew in that situation has to accept the idea that what's good for Israel in the long run depends in part not just on Israel, but on what the United States does, on the world community. And frankly, I think part of the sense of never again after the Holocaust is not just the idea that there never will be a Holocaust again, but also in a certain way that we Jewish people will never again be in a position to be dependent on you for our survival. And of course, the story of Israel is partly a miracle story of what the Jewish people did, but it's also, in fact, the story of dependence. It's also, in fact, a story of how Israel relied on world support in the form of the United Nations resolution, in the form of Czechoslovakian arms at the time of the original fight for the state in the 40s, on French arms between 47 and 67, on U.S. arms and aid since then. So in fact, it is a story of how even today Israel, and in all of its history, has to a certain extent depended on the world community, on certain powers, for its survival. And yet, of course, it was those powers that had abandoned the Jewish people. And so I think, in a certain sense, while I think there's a tendency to, among non-Jews, to kind of have this sense that the Jewish community has such power in regard to this issue. In a sense, I think the Jewish community wants to believe it too. Wants to believe it because in a certain sense, then it would be as if Israel's fate is in our hands, and in our hands we can trust its fate. But the fact is, it's much more complicated than that in terms of what are the reasons why the U.S. supports Israel. And so working in an interfaith context, working in a broad community context with others to support to encourage our government to do the things that might help Israel survive and be at peace with its neighbors, means acknowledging that today Israel's fate continues to depend on the U.S., on the world community, et cetera, on others. Well, you know, that list by itself, I think, is probably enough to make you say, well, it's impossible. We can't work together on this issue. Wait till the other two lists get American Muslims and Arab American Christians. What are some of the issues they have to face? Well, first of all, you can appreciate, I think, that the American Muslim community is just beginning to emerge publicly as a presence in our midst. How many of you know a Muslim, an American Muslim? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are some 5 to 7 million American Muslims. I've been in a number of cities where the first time we bring religious leaders together to talk about this, one of the things that happens is that Jews and Christians find out where the mosque is. Up until that point, they didn't even know where the mosque was. And in an atmosphere where the American Muslim community is just emerging publicly, in other words, it's almost, in a sense, as an immigrant community, just beginning to poke its head above the surface, you know? You think this is the first issue they would like to deal with? Unlikely. How about recycling? How about participating in a Thanksgiving Day interfaith service? In other words, something safe, something very acceptable, something very non-controversial is more likely to be the early ways in which an emerging community or a community emerging publicly for the first time in America wants to be seen. It wants to be seen like others. Not having bitterness and pains
and being hostile to Israel and even hostile to Jews because of their connection. I mean, God knows that isn't the way a community would want to emerge. So the first point that I think you'd have to say is that given that even the Arab American Christian community, which is somewhat more visible, although as an organized community is still relatively new on the public landscape, certainly the American Muslim community is new, that there's a wariness of poking their heads up on this particular issue. Second, and part of that is not just that it's controversial, but also a fear that if they come out and speak on this issue, they're likely to experience an awful lot of prejudice and stereotypes toward them. And nobody wants to experience prejudice toward them. In some ways, they'd rather have the illusion that it isn't there. They know it's there. But in terms of happiness, in terms of daily life, in terms of your kids and so forth, you'd rather, in a certain sense, not say it. So you stay away from issues that might particularly, in a particular way, bring it to the surface. Second, for Muslims and Arab Americans, Christians, American Muslims and Arab American Christians, another thing is that in talking about this issue, inevitably it involves sharing a certain history of suffering and failures, defeats. And that involves also a certain sort of confession among themselves and then publicly that part of the reason for the failures and defeats is a failure of Arab leadership. And just as Jews are nervous about sharing certain of their debate and their criticisms of Israel publicly, I think many Arab American Christians and Muslims are wary about sharing their sense of criticism of Arab leaders publicly, in part because they feel there's almost no sympathy for Arabs out there anyway. And so if you share criticism of Arab leaders, what it does is just fuel prejudices and hostility toward Arabs, and there's no complexity to it at all. I mean, take Arafat, for instance. Many Palestinians are critical of many of the things that Arafat has done or not done. But given, if you will, the general reputation of Arafat in the American scene and the American media, to talk critically about Arafat, what you're doing is just laying more stuff on Arafat's head when you as a Palestinian may feel a lot of support for Arafat even though you're critical. So you worry, you sort of get defensive about it. I think it's quite understandable, not necessarily helpful, because then you're getting defensive about Arafat makes people think sort of that you know, how come you can't see that the terrorist action that hijacks an airplane isn't helpful, you know? Another part of it, I think another part of the problem for our Americans and American Muslims, which is not similar, I mean, it's different than the Jewish experience, is that for Arab American Muslims and Arab American Christians, there is this sense of puzzlement and deep troubledness about where did Arab greatness go? I mean, it was only, after all, about 600 years ago, 500, 600 years ago, when the Arab Muslim world was the center of civilization, or was certainly a high point of civilization in terms of science and philosophy and the arts and architecture and so on and so forth around the Mediterranean. And I think Arabs still have trouble understanding where did that greatness go? What happened to it? So sharing that kind of anguish with people who there's a general feeling among Arabs don't understand much of that, may be puzzled when you say that Arab Islamic civilization or Arab Islamic world was the center of civilization. People may look at you and say, what are you talking about, you know? Because that sort of doesn't come through very strongly in our Western history. So talking about that in an anguished way, Arabs sort of are nervous because they don't feel there's no take on it. Now, it's also... for Palestinian Americans, they have a similar problem to American Jews in terms of working with Jews, as Jews have with working with Palestinians, because, you know, most Palestinians, they have a history of suffering, certainly since the 40s, somewhat earlier in terms of the conflict between the two national movements. They have an experience of being refugees. They have experience of not being able to go home, to home in the sense of where their grandparents and their parents and so on, where their ancestors are. And in order for them to work with American Jews for peace, They have to not only be willing to share that suffering, but they have to then listen and be able to somehow empathize with Jewish suffering, pre-state and post the creation of Israel. And that's very hard to do, and most people don't want to do it. In other words, if you've suffered at the hands of somebody, you're not, and you're still suffering, you feel yourself still suffering, to then enter into their suffering, that's asking a lot of anybody. So I think there's some real heart issues, and this is only, you know, a brief list, and we might think of others in our discussion. What about us, most of us? Most of us being non-Arab American Christians. What are some of the things that what are some of the issues that we have to deal with? Well, the basic one, I think, is the temptation to think that we come to consideration of this conflict with clean hands. There's a famous or infamous quotation from an American ambassador in the early 50s who made the remark, "If only the Arabs and Jews could deal with their conflict like good Christians." Well, that puts the temptation rather starkly, you know? It puts it sort of in a barefaced enough way that anybody probably understands what I mean by the temptation to come to this conflict with a sense that we have clean hands. But there is that temptation. There is that temptation. I mean, I hear it in church where someone will say, well, you know, if only the Arabs would do that and only the Israelis would do that. Or sometimes it's only in one direction, you know, if only the Israelis or if only the Arabs. We have a sense of, we've got answers, they've got problems, we've got answers, you know. And it's an American temptation. Goes with power to a certain extent. With our sort of history in this century, or at least some of our history in this century. But it's also a Western Christian temptation in regard to Jews and Arabs. And therefore, the first issue and very basic issue we have to deal with is remembering, or if we have to, relearning the history, our history as non-Arab Christians with Jews, with the Jewish people, and with Arabs. And it is not, by and large, a very pleasant history. It's not very pleasant. But it's all there. And, of course, it tends to be a history that we forget more than Jews or Arabs forget it. That has something to do with the fact that they suffered it. And when you suffer it, you tend to remember it longer. So we have to understand that when we start talking about this with Arabs or with Jews, that there's a lot of history there that's very painful. And that we, or our ancestors, our people, our traditions, have been a part of creating that suffering. But it's not just history. It's also, I would say, the persistent underlying prejudices that we have toward Jews and toward Arabs. Toward Jews. I think, by and large, non-Arab Christians, and I'm talking particularly non-Arab Christians, so I think Arab Christians may suffer the same thing too. Non-Arab Christians, we tend to be happier thinking about the Jews as another religious group, like Presbyterians and Mormons or something, you know. Another religious group, rather than understanding them as a people. That idea fits more our mold. I think we get uncomfortable with the idea of Jews as a people, as a tribe in the historical sense, as a tribe, as a nation. And our both ignorance or lack of understanding about that, in some sense our lack of sympathy for that, is part of the reason I think we're uncomfortable with the notion of Zionism. For Zionism, very simply, is the expression of Jewish nationalism. Not all Jews supported, not all Jews were Zionists, but many were, and more were, as this century wore on, or at least if not Zionists, identify themselves as Zionists, supporters of the idea of a Jewish state. And I think a lot of us are uncomfortable with that idea of being Jewish, that you're a Jewish nationalist. And of course, if we're uncomfortable with that, what we are really saying we're uncomfortable with is the moral legitimacy for the creation of the State of Israel. In other words, it's interesting, if you do a poll, I think you'd find a lot of people say, well, I support Israel. But then if you do, you ask them, do you support Zionism, I think you'd get a much lower positive response, and maybe even a majority saying no. And then you've got a very confusing situation. Because the very moral legitimacy of Israel is based on the idea that Jews are a people and have a right to a national expression. And so if you support Israel and you don't support Zionism, Jews would get worried. Because it's like you've taken away, or you've saying you don't support the concept, self-concept of Jews as a people. Problem. Another thing I think that happens a lot with us is that we tend to have a relatively one-dimensional view of Israel. We tend not to see the variety in Israel. And that we tend, some of us, to react very defensively to any criticism of Israel. I'm talking about as Christians. We react very defensively to any criticism of Israel because we feel like maybe that's criticism of Jews or it's anti-Jewish, while others of us tend to latch on to criticisms of Israel and in a way allow that criticism to give vent to some maybe more underlying resentment we have toward Jews. And I think I've seen both in discussions I've had with Christians. That the first, the being defensive as Christians, and we shouldn't criticize Israel because of a sense of guilt about our relationship with the Jewish people, and we don't want to do anything that smacks of anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic prejudice. But on the other hand, I think I've also seen how when people express their criticism of Israeli policies which many Jews would be critical of, or are critical of, there's a way in which, in some Christians, this opens a window and all of a sudden some stuff starts coming out that smells and hears, sounds and looks like something more than just criticism of Israeli policy. Something, you know how the Jews are, kind of things, that touches back into some pretty deep and uncomfortable, certainly for Jews and hopefully for us, anti-Jewish prejudice. Now, if we have these kind of prejudices, persistent prejudices and lack of understanding of Jews, I think we certainly have them of Arabs and Muslims. I mean, I think the stereotypes of Arabs as backward, and of course these stereotypes tend to be contradictory, but I think they're all there, backward, tending toward fanaticism, oil-rich, terrorist. I mean, I think these still are images which carry an awful lot of, to which a lot of us remain emotionally, if not in our minds, emotionally attached when we think of Arabs. In regard to the Palestinians, certainly our idea of what the PLO is, what the PLO and what Arafat is I think for many, a stereotyped idea, a prejudiced idea, certainly compared, never mind trying to speak objectively, but certainly compared to the way Palestinians see the PLO. Palestinians see the PLO as a flawed but necessary vehicle for the expression of their nationalism, the organization which gives expression to nationalism, which has a lot of garbage in it, a lot of corruption in it, a lot of nobility in it, a lot of inspiration in it, a lot of idealism in it, a lot of conflict in it. I mean, all the things that a nationalist movement has, the PLO has. But I think there's been a tendency in our society to see the PLO in rather one-dimensional, negative terms. And so for a Jew, when there's this sort of, when an American Jew picks up from us as non-Arab Christians, a sense that Zionism makes us uncomfortable, Jewish nationalism makes us uncomfortable, and we don't particularly like it, just as that makes Jews feel very much pushed in a corner and very defensive, I think for many Palestinian Americans, when we express in questions sometimes or in statements other times our rather narrow idea of what the PLO is, it makes Palestinians feel very defensive, and as if you don't understand, and I don't know if I even want to help you to try to understand. I think another problem we have as non-Arab Christians is that we want to view this conflict, or we tend to view this conflict as a right versus wrong. I think we like to view conflicts that way. And for some of us, and it may also be connected, I mean, in some ways it's connected just to a basic impulse, right? Which side is right? And oddly enough, sometimes what happens with American Christians is that they flip-flop. I remember an American rabbi from Boston, in the first conference to form this committee, he said, you know, he said, I'm less nervous being here with Palestinian Americans than I am with my Western Christian colleagues. And people were puzzled. He said, I'll have to explain that. He said, but Palestinian Americans who are here, I know what I don't know about them and what I really want to try to find out. But my Western Christian colleagues, whom I know much better and have worked with on many issues, I'm more nervous about them because I have a feeling that they can wake up from one morning to the next and totally change their view about Israel. And in a certain sense, that happened, I think, for many American Christians in the last 15 years, where there was, going through the 60s and most of the 70s, a kind of general support for Israel. And then the war in Lebanon happened. I think that was one of the series of events which caused people to do a flip-flop, when people all of a sudden saw the images of Palestinians in Beirut being bombarded, the city being bombarded, and Palestinians suffering and seeming to bravely defend themselves against Israeli might, military might. And then, of course, the story of Sabra and Shatila, the refugee camp. And although Israelis didn't do that, Jews didn't do that, Christians did it. They did it under Israeli wing, in the sense that Israeli military controlled the area. And you found Christians all of a sudden popping out of a kind of general support for Israel to a kind of emotional support for the Palestinians. And then the Intifada came along in 87 and reinforced that, a kind of, you know, the Palestinians are like the blacks or the Vietnamese and we should be sympathetic to them, or the El Salvadorians. And part of it, of course, is what experience do we bring to this that we then lay on this conflict and try to fit the conflict into our sort of molds of perception. So we have to, that's another issue that I think American Christians have to struggle with. Well, as I said it when I finished the list of some things that I thought American issues American Jews have to deal with, that's an awful lot. And in a certain sense, if it serves no other purpose, this topic helps us to understand why we don't work together for peace in the Middle East. And I think, you know, that's something already to understand that. I mean, at least even if, you know, most of us will go back to our communities and not work together with Jews or Christians or Muslims on this issue, maybe we'll have some sense why, if we tried, it would be difficult. I think it's also terribly important to have an awareness of these issues and other issues if we're going to try to do anything about it, because it's thick, it's complicated. But the positive note I'd end this on is to say that I think if I'm even reasonably accurate in describing these as some of the issues we have to deal with in working together, one can appreciate that if we work together, we are making a kind of progress humanly that is not only important perhaps for the Middle East, but also in terms of human relations, that's quite extraordinary. In other words, if we can make it through this mud, which mud appears not when we try to work together on recycling. Most of the time we can get away with working together on recycling, or perhaps the homeless, or hunger issues. We can get away with working on those issues together as Jews, Christians, and Muslims without dealing with the lists that I've just offered. If we deal with the Middle East together, or if try to deal with the Middle East, my guess is you have to deal with these issues. But what I'm saying about it positively is, to the extent that we're able to do that, to the extent we have an instinct to try to do that and work on doing that, the progress that we're making by getting through those things, beginning to establish relations through this stuff that's so thick and so awful, really, so uncomfortable, is really a tremendous kind of progress. And it seems to me it's what a reconciliatory peace eventually has to be about. And in that sense, it's worth doing. And in a sense, also, to the extent that we're not doing it, that we're sort of, you know, a little bit dancing around some very thick stuff that we gotta do.
Can it be sort of like a hands-on, hands-off kind of help?
Say a little bit more, Gene.
Understanding the different sides, or knowing about different sides, would it be better to be a help for the different sides, or not wanting to help the sides
I guess what I, if I'm hearing your question, I think that understanding the different views is not paralyzing. It does tend to be empowering. It does tend to make one more able to help than one is if one doesn't understand. And to whatever extent we're working to understand it, we can be more helpful, even just in a discussion in an office or a school or in a synagogue or church or mosque, you know, just even in a private way and with other people, we can be more helpful. And in a public way, I think we can be more helpful. If politicians, you know, had a sense of some of these things when they're talking about this issue, I think, and gave expression to that in their statements, in their public way of talking about this, I think it would be helpful. It would be
and probably working with the people of the American Jews or the American Palestinian Muslims.
But surely, if politicians spent more time listening to the different, they would gather some of this, and there are some, you know, members of Congress who have done this and
learning.
Yes. Who else? Or what else? Maybe other things that come to your mind that are difficult in these in trying to work together, or some other, or just questions, or.
Okay. One thing which is slightly off the point of the working together, but something I've noticed is, I've seen in knowing, I know a bunch of students from the Gulf states, typically. Those are the Muslims that I know, the group that I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed an incredible prejudice against Palestinians amongst Saudis and Kuwaitis and Qataris and people. And that seems to be a real strike against them if they're considered third-class citizens in the Arab world to start off with, and then they've got to try and make peace with everybody else. That really seems to be a very sad thing. And is that, I mean, am I right that there's some of that prejudice?
Over how long a time would you say you noticed that?
The last 10 years, which is my exposure to those people. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, oh, so-and-so's from Jordan, in a conversation with a Saudi, and he'll say, well, he's really Palestinian, as if, well, you know, he's even worse than you think,
right,
sort of thing. And I was shocked to encounter that, and
right,
sad to encounter it so much, and I wonder how it affects the Arab, the Palestinian situation.
Well, one of the things that helps one, can help one understand Arafat and the PLO is that there are very few liberation movements that have had to rely on support from such a diverse group of states as the Arab states in terms of the politics and ideologies and et cetera of them. And what Arafat, you know, did, I mean, part of what the PLO did over those years was to try to cater to certain things about Saudi Arabia, and cater to certain things about Syria, and cater to certain things about Jordan and Egypt and so forth, to try to keep on good terms with all of those states. So when you say, you know, is that part of the problem? It certainly is part of the problem for Palestinians as a people, for the PLO as an organization. Part of the resentment that you're talking about or disdain, I mean, part of it for the particular states that you mentioned are most likely the students who come from those states come from the elites. Mm. They're very wealthy, or families are very wealthy, and so there's a kind of, you know, if you ask them to talk about the country people in their own country, I mean rural people in their own country, you'd probably hear much the same tone about those people. In other words, if you ask a person from Saudi Arabia, Saudi, to talk about the Bedouin, or to talk about the people who live outside of Riyadh and Jeddah and out of the capital in the country, I think you probably hear some of the same sort of disdain, and it partly goes with kind of being wealthy and kind of being urban and educated and a kind of class thing. I think part of it also is that the Palestinians have been remarkably successful in a number of these countries economically. I mean, one of the things they said about Kuwait is that if you looked, and they say about Jordan too, but Jordan is right next to Palestine, they say about Kuwait, is that Palestinians had, despite the fact that they didn't have citizenship, had worked their way into very key positions in the economy of Kuwait. And there's a kind of resentment among native Kuwaitis about that. The reason I asked about the time frame is that
certainly the last 3 or 4 years with the war with Iraq, there's been an upsurge in that sort of resentment. But I think, you know, you said 10 years, and I think that has to do with wealth and elite, a feeling of being the elite, a feeling of resentment of these Palestinians. They're refugees, and they seem to work their way into high positions in the economy. Part of the reason is that Palestinians, like Jews, are very highly educated. In fact, among all the peoples in the Middle East, the Palestinians and the Jews are the two most highly educated populations. And the reason is similar in both cases. That is, Jews for centuries lived without a state. And so one of the things that parents encouraged their kids to do was to get an education so that no matter where they lived, no matter whose state they were in, they would have something to contribute. Well, Palestinians, having become refugees in 48, Palestinian families did the same thing. They encouraged their kids to get educated. And they've been doing that for some time, but it became more intensified. So there's a kind of resentment about that, you know? That here are these refugees that are, you know, running my country. And if you look at the small Gulf states, you'll find the influence of Palestinians in the economy, not in the government necessarily, but in the economy, is very, very strong. Certainly it's true in Jordan. Yes? Someone else? A question about...
Ron?
Yeah.
Speaking also on what Leslie was saying, it's analogous to the Indians taking over the corner markets in Britain. And we find here Vietnamese and Asiatics taking over the 7-Elevens and so forth, that entrepreneurial spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And in Kuwait, at least 50% of the managerial positions were in the hands of the Palestinians. And that's some other things that I wanted to throw in here.
And of course, that they've been pushed out of those now. I mean,
yes.
Part of the disaster of the Gulf War was that Palestinians, now large numbers, 350,000 or more, have been pushed out of Kuwait, large numbers of them having gone to Jordan, which just puts the burden on Jordan in a way.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And Leslie was mentioning, is it because they're looked upon as a lower class? But I think in actuality it's reversed. They're looked upon as the real upper class.
They're too successful.
In a sense, almost the Kuwaitis recognizing those in their upper class, the reason I have this wealth and so forth is because of ancient privileges, inherited and so forth, but when it comes to matching my expertise with this immigrant here, I can't match him.
Right.
He's the one I need to run my oil field.
Right. No, the Kuwaitis had a particular formula. The way they did that was they would seek out someone who could help them, and most cases it was a Palestinian, and they would make a partnership where the Palestinian would not be able to have majority control because he's not a citizen. But imagine some of the sort of feelings if you're a native Kuwaiti, and that in order for your business to succeed, you feel like you've got to find a Palestinian to work with you. Well, in one sense, you're very appreciative. But in another sense, underneath, there's a kind of, you know, resentment about, what's wrong with me? And therefore, rather than face that, you say, what's wrong with you?
The other points I wanted to throw in is that some of the things that may be happening that are below the surface is the rising of the Masada complex with the Jews as they see themselves surrounded by enemies, and the potential of being abandoned as they view it again. You mentioned yesterday about the rising number of Arabs.
Say Masada. I'm not sure everyone knows. Say what the Masada is briefly.
The plateau area in this northern part of the Negev, southern Israel, in which in the 3rd century, as part of the great revolt against the Romans, when the Romans, in suppressing it, destroyed Jerusalem, but also there was a group known as Zealots, from which we get the word zealous, who sneaked up and by a shepherd's path on the back side of this plateau, which is only about 300 feet high, and at nighttime overcame a small Roman garrison that was there, slew them, and it took 3 years for the Romans to suppress them, and they did it by bringing in an army of slaves and digging a ramp. Imagine tipping a football field on its end that high in order to run their war engines up to the top. Now the key thing about Masada was not that the Romans won, but that the leaders of the Zealots, recognizing that on the following day they were going to be overcome in some way, decided that their options were we surrender, we go down fighting, or we kill ourselves or whatever. And they decided that they would kill themselves. Now, they supposedly, according to the Israeli historian, at least one woman and two children that survived this self-immolation. And since that time, it's been remarked, and in fact, all the members of the Israeli tank corps are taken to the top to be sworn into service, and one Israeli politician is credited with saying that never again shall it be a Masada, that with what we've got under Dimona, the three tunnels with the
meaning
nuclear,
the nuclear.
That the next time, if Israel's to go, the others will go too.
Well, it's interesting that within Israel, just in the last 15, 20 years, there has emerged scholarship which has demonstrated that at that time there was fairly vigorous debate among Jews as to what should be done. And the option of surrendering or compromising was in fact supported by a significant number of Jews. And I say within recent years that's come out in part because the current debate in Israel can in part be characterized by those on one side who say we have to make a compromise with the Palestinians in order for Israel to survive. We have to give up some of the land that we captured in 67. We have to maybe allow for a Palestinian state. And those on the other side who say no, that we just, you know, never give back an inch, never compromise a thing. And in a certain sense, it's an argument that you can trace back even to the Masada times, even to the time of Masada. Some of the critics of the current Israeli government, like a man like Ariel Sharon, in what he says, or some of the things Shamir says, there's a kind of, you get this feeling like, as an Israeli once said to me, that Begin thought that the definition of a Jew was to fight and die. Well, you know, you say, that's craziness, but it also relates to the history of the Jews. I mean, it's not every people who would come up with that as a possible idea for the definition of who you are. But it's not entirely, it's possible to understand why a Jew might come up with that history given Jewish history. But what the answer to that, if that on the one side, that the Arabs are never going to make peace, we are going to have to fight them till the end of time, we're going to have to stand here and fight, we may eventually lose, but we're going to fight, we're going to bring down the Middle East with nuclear weapons, etc. That attitude on one side. And the other side, people saying, I'm not sure it'll work, but for the sake of my son and my granddaughter, I believe we have to try to make a compromise. We have to make an accommodation. We have to try to work it out. And those two approaches, in some ways, that's too simplistic, but that's the way some of the debate goes in Israel today.
Let me add in that there, that as the Arab immigration into our country increases, a great percentage of them are the displaced Palestinians, as you mentioned, the best educated, the most entrepreneurial. And these people will, in time, imitate the Jewish voting bloc, the greatest voting bloc we've ever had in the history of our republic. Small numbers, but willing to expend money and defeat people who don't support Israel, even in a precinct in Wyoming, where there's not even a Jew living there. And as the Palestinians come to do this, I think wise Jewish leaders are beginning to see the trend of the future, plus the tiredness of the American people, and also our economic inability to continue this $10 billion under the table almost every year. And therefore, now this is kind of a myopic appearance perhaps on the part of Jews, but as this complex comes on, once again we must crank up the old thing about the persecution of Jews. So interestingly enough, this year is the 50th anniversary of the real cranking up of the persecution in the concentration camps of Jews. And so, overlooking the fact that the Nazi records show at least 5 million non-Jews killed in those camps, this year we've had the opening of at least 3 Holocaust museums, all of which concentrated on who getting killed in those camps? Jews. And so it's almost like, we've got to convince these people once again to keep up the aid to us. Now here's where the more moderate Jews are going to have once again their opportunity, that if we go this route, it's not going to work, that the Americans will continue to slide, as particularly if the Cold War continues to taper off further and further away from us. And obviously oil is very important to us. And so I'm sure we're reaching a crisis within the Jewish community as a result of this.
I think the problem is so hard in part because I can't imagine that there could be enough done ever to help us remember the Holocaust. I can't imagine that there could ever be enough done.
But a Holocaust to remember for everyone.
No. The Holocaust to Jewish people.
No. A Christian dying or an atheist dying in a concentration camp.
Leslie, you missed the fact that when Hitler brought together 13 of the most brilliant men in Germany, scientists, philosophers, engineers, I mean some of the most prestigious university people in Germany, he brought them together for the explicit purpose, and it's written in the records, to design a plan to get rid of the Jews. Now, other people were massacred, it's clear. But Hitler had a plan to get rid of the Jews. And what I'm saying, I don't think there is ever, I can't imagine a time when we will have done enough to understand, to remember and understand the horror of that. The problem is that understanding the horror of that has to be part of making a commitment to not let horrors, anything like that, happen to anyone. And there are Jews who come to that conclusion, and there are Christians who come to that conclusion, indeed there are Arabs, Muslims who come to that conclusion, and that's where we have to work. I think if we wind up somehow saying there's been too much done on the Holocaust, or too much done about the extermination of the Jews, and somehow see that as the way to say, well, there's got to be more done for the Palestinians, sort of pulling and hauling, I don't think it works, and I don't think that's where the answer lies. Somehow it's going straight through as much as we can know about the Holocaust and coming out and coming through it saying, and yes, the Palestinians. Right. So that Elie Wiesel, when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, spoke about the suffering of the Palestinians. And a Palestinian in Jordan wrote an editorial in the Jordanian newspaper saying, thank you, Elie Wiesel. And he said in the opening of this editorial, many of you who read this, Arabs who read this, will be critical of me for saying anything positive about Elie Wiesel because he's been so single-mindedly focused on the Holocaust. But he said, I think I can understand why he would be, and I am appreciative, even at this late date, whenever it was, 1985, something like that, that he spoke of the suffering of the Palestinians. Somehow I think if it gets to pulling and hauling between our suffering and their suffering, or generalized, in a way that misses the particular way in which Nazism tried to exterminate.